Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery. With your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCAA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, and Mr. Dave North Martino is in the room.
I am here, and you're using my full name. It's crazy.
Yeah, I thought it'd be.
I never know what to do.
Well, yeah, you're waiting for that snide comment. So you can
I am.
And now you don't know. It's like, wow.
I know.
Yeah, but remember, it's you'd be really nice to them, and then you get them.
Yeah. I'm waiting
from behind. How it works
when I'm not expecting it.
When you're not expecting it, expect it.
Expect it.
That was an old term from an old show. I can't remember it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
Things are becoming distant in the mind.
I know.
Every day. Well, here we go. So now we've got an author. I'd like to say true crime, but I'd also like to say mystery. We've got an author. Let's just say that. He's got a new book out. It's called Below the Line, and it's a Hollywood crime novel. It's Mr. Lowell Caulfield. Thank you for being here.
Hey, it's great to be here, and thanks for having me, both of you guys, Alan and David.
Well, so Lowell, what happened to you as a kid? I say this because now you've written quite a few books, but it seems like to be on the darker side, like your House of Secrets and things like that are all a little bit darker, I would think. Why go there? Like, what is it about that made you decide to sit down and write those kind of stories?
Well, they're real dark, but it kind of actually began in my childhood. It's funny you mentioned that. I was a big fan of shock theater and those old Universal movies, Frankenstein and Dracula, all the great black and white classics. So I always had an interest in things that scared people. But as I got older and I became a newspaper reporter, and I found myself covering a lot of homicides. I worked for the Detroit News, and Detroit is like a crime theme park. You know, I may describe Detroit as like New York with a lot more guns.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very in-your-face kind of place. And
my friends in Canada, in Windsor, my friends in Windsor say you can hear the gunfire from Detroit across the bridge.
Oh, yeah, Windsor. Windsor. Been to Windsor many times. But I think it was, though, my buddy Robert McKee, the screenwriter guru, who said that to really understand the positive side of humanity, you have to really mind the dark side. And so I really got into minding the dark side. And I think where it started with the true crime books for me is, I became a very hard drinking, half a gallon of whiskey a day, reporter in Detroit. I never lost a job, but I, full blown alcoholic. And then when I got into recovery, I kind of developed a fascination with why people get obsessed with things, why maybe I got obsessed with things, you know, why was I a drinker and all that. And in part of my recovery, I started doing the true crime books to kind of mine that dark side. And so that's how it all got started. And so I did, four or five nonfiction crime books. And then the last one I did, House of Secrets, was kind of finished me off. And so I moved over to fiction and then eventually came out here to L.A. and to do film and television. So that's sort of the quick bio.
Yeah, Dave does a half gallon of whiskey right now. He's in that place.
we've got a seat saved for you, okay? In the meetings, yeah. You know, I'll put your name on one of the seats.
He calls himself a whiskey connoisseur.
Yes. Aficionado.
Yeah, aficionado. Okay, yeah. Okay. You call it that.
I had a wine cellar, too. You know, I had a wine cellar, and then we got into a lot of another substance one weekend, and the wine cellar all got drank up in 3 days. Wow. So, you know.
Wow. There we go. Well, you know.
It's called alcoholism.
Yeah. You know, House of Secrets was pretty deep, and I know that when I've written certain crime books, especially one, for me, it was Murder Time 6 in my path. And that, yeah, I understand what you mean by you're finished with it. It's just too much. And that kind of happened with me. So now I'm kind of doing other things, taking a break, so to speak, from I filled out my contracts and finished them off, got that all done. Now I'm free, so to speak. So I think I'll be doing fiction as well. So I know what you mean. Because I've been there, you know, I didn't have a wine cellar, but I know what you mean by the dark side. So how do you handle something like that? Or what is it for you that was the most troublesome?
Well, actually, I did pretty well with the first three or four of them. But it was that last one, House of Secrets, which I thought was going to be an easy book. And it turned out to be a 3-year job. And, you know, that particular story, there was a patriarch down in Akron, Ohio. He had 13 kids, and he was creating a super race by having kids with his daughters, and they went on a cross-country crime spree, and he ordered his kids to kill people. And it just, you know, I just kind of lost all, and I was sober. I mean, all my books I did sober. I dreamt about doing a lot of books drunk and never got one written, but when I got sober, I've done 9. But that particular story, I just lost all faith in humanity. The world looked like such a dark place after talking to all those kids and seeing what had happened in that particular story. And I became clinically depressed. I mean, I had to seek help. And I called them. The funny thing was, is I told the publisher, I said, I tried to get out of the deal, even after 2 years of research. Said, I don't want to do this book. It's too messed up. It's too dark. It's too crazy. Nobody's going to buy it. And they said, well, you got to do it. And so I tried to write it, and I only got 29 pages out in 2 months, which is, I mean, I'm a 6 to 8 pages a day guy. And that's why I went and saw a physician, and he said, well, you got dysthymia. It's a form of depression. And he put me on an antidepressant. And then I wrote the book in 2 months. I felt like I was climbing out of hell. I had to finish the book and get it to the publishers. So I sent it to the publishers, and back then we used to FedEx, you know, the manuscript. I FedEx the manuscript. You remember that?
We were just talking about that.
Yeah. And I called up my editor, Paul Dienes at Kensington. I said, I don't want to hear about this book. I don't want to see the cover. I don't, you know, I'm done with it. I'm done with true crime. And the funny thing happened was, like, a year and a half later, Google had just, like, gotten really popular. And I Googled my own name, and I saw Lowell Caulfield in New York Times. I went, like, wow, I haven't been in the Times in a while. I wonder what this is about. And I went there, and I was on their paperback bestseller list. Once I'd gone to paperback, I called up the publisher, I called up Paul, and I said, Paul, I'm on the New York Times bestseller list. How come you didn't call me? And he said, you said you didn't want to hear anything. You know, but yeah, that kind of finished me off, and I can't be in that kind of negative. I decided to start writing novels because I could affect the ending, and there could be redeeming qualities. In House of Secrets, there was nothing redeeming about the book, but people bought it like crazy. I think it went, it's a 22nd printing. I mean, it's crazy how well it sold.
Yeah. Are you surprised with how popular, I guess would be a good word, and how fascinated society is, especially American society, with true crime and murder and all this gore and stuff? Like, they eat up all these books. They watch all these shows 24/7, you know, like Nancy Grace is a poster child now, you know. Are you surprised with how much people are drawn to this kind of dark stuff?
I'm surprised it's kept going. I mean, when I was doing it, I was publishing in hardcover, and my books are really in depth. I mean, I'd maybe cover the trial, but that's just the beginning. That's just like a Rolodex of who I need to talk to. And I find bigger themes about America and all these other things. And that's how you got up into hardcover. And then they stopped doing hardcovers and started doing a lot of paperback originals. And it kind of went the way of the Western. I thought, well, and then OJ was kind of like the back last big story. And I thought, well, it's over with, and, you know, I'm going to move on too. But now I'm surprised at how it's ubiquitous in streaming and documentaries and all this. And I think that I believe the reason people read true crime is they're really examining themselves. They want to know the difference between themselves and these people that do these things. I mean, we all have the ability of anger, even rage, duplicity. You know, we work as human beings on keeping that stuff in check. And I think that the reason people are fascinated with these stories is they want to see where the wheels came off. And in doing that, they can also pat themselves on the back. Think, well, yeah, you know, maybe I cheated on my wife, but I didn't go kill her. You know, I mean, it's a self-affirming kind of thing to watch this stuff.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's fascinating to me and how popular it really is. And it's just, you know, it's inundated with all this stuff, you know, negative stuff. So, so how did you build back into getting to this new book? So you've got a new book out now. This is not true crime. But I can tell by the sound of the book, there's a lot of elements in it that are true for you and for part of your life, you know, bringing Detroit into it and stuff. How did this start for you, this book?
Well, this is actually my first book in more than 20 years, because I did a couple of novels back when I was living in Michigan, in the suburbs of Detroit, after I'd moved out of the city. And I did a book called Marker. And Elmore Leonard was a good friend of mine. I was kind of influenced by him, his approach to doing fiction. He made crime fiction entertaining. And I like the idea of taking a crime story and making it entertaining. And the way it gets entertaining is you have characters that particularly criminals who are kind of legends in their own mind. And I mean, a great example of that is Get Shorty. You even see it in the film, you know. So I gravitated towards that kind of style. But my daughter came out here. She was a graduate of the University of Michigan, musical theater graduate. She started doing film, and she did, you know, some really big movies too, like Legally Blonde and Road Trip, and she was on the Carrie Show. And I was surfing the Great Lakes. Yes, you can surf the Great Lakes. And so I came out here to, I got an offer to adapt my first book, my first nonfiction book, Masquerade, to film. I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, I really ought to go to LA and maybe make some contacts. One thing led to another, and a particular agency found me and said, boy, you'd be a great show creator, you know, creator of TV series. So I spent the next 20 years in that business. I sold half a dozen pilots, HBO, CBS. They didn't get picked up, but I made a decent living doing that. I also developed a film called Stockholm, starring Ethan Hawke. Came out a couple of years ago. It's about the Stockholm Syndrome, but it's based on the bank robbery in 1972 in Stockholm, Sweden, that created the term. So anyway, I had all these experiences in the west side of LA and Hollywood. And particularly when I first came here, coming from Detroit, I mean, Detroit is It's an in-your-face kind of place. You have a dispute with somebody, you know, you can yell at them, and they'll yell back, and, man, well, go have a nice day and whatever. Here you do that, and the people call the police on you. I mean, it's a passive-aggressive culture here, at least on the West Side, a very passive-aggressive. The business is so much that way. People get offended really easy. You kind of tiptoe around. You're walking on eggshells a lot. There's a lot of strange things that go on. You know, I remember I scared one of my first producers at Spelling Entertainment. They bought one of my shows. And one of the executives called up. My agent said, Lowell scares us. You know, because I'm really direct. You know, I came out of the news business, you know, the Detroit news business. And so anyway, I had all these experiences over the period of 20 years in the business. And I thought, and then COVID hit and, you know, we're all locked down. And I thought, you know, I'm going to take these experiences I've had and, you know, alter them, of course, you know, to protect the guilty and create these characters and kind of expose what Hollywood and West Side of L.A. is like within the context of a crime novel. And so in Below the Line, I pick a Detroit homicide cop, and I knew all those guys. I did a lot of work with Detroit Homicide when I was there. He gets a number of different circumstances. He ends up becoming retiring and coming out to L.A. to become a consultant on TV and TV shows and films. And a lot of that goes on. A lot of the consultants that work in these crime series and stuff, these broadcast series, are, you know, they're former cops. And then, you know, he has a good run for a couple of years, and then he turns 50. And one of the things you got to fight as you get older out here is there is really kind of a prejudice against, you know, older white men. The Writers Guild of America, in fact, sued on age discrimination and won a huge class action lawsuit out of it. And so his career starts going down, and a former producer he worked with, you know, calls him up and has got a job for him. And he wants him to find somebody, a missing woman and her kid, for a friend of a friend. But in classic Hollywood style, he doesn't get paid. He'll get paid sometime in the future with a job. And that's a classic Hollywood hustle. Everybody wants you to work for nothing. Anyway, so I mean, I'm starting to delineate the plot here a little bit. But the point is, the way I got into it is I wanted to take those experiences and those kind of people and the kind of dialogue that goes on and the absurdities. Here's something kind of interesting. When because my second agent was able to sell the book, my first agent didn't quite get the book. He said, you know, if this doesn't, you know, these Hollywood people that you've got in this book, they're not making any sense. They're doing irrational, illogical things.
And
you've got to rewrite that. I said, no, that's the whole point. That's, you know, he never got it, you know?
Yeah.
But my editor at Arcade really got it. She loved it. She loved the humor of it. So there's a lot of kind of humor in this book, but it's a serious crime book too. I mean, it's a serious, I wouldn't call it a mystery. I would call it a crime novel. You know, in the same way Elmer Leonard, you wouldn't call his stuff mysteries. You know, they're kind of character studies with sometimes you know exactly who did it. But the question becomes, are they going to get away with it? You know, that kind of thing.
Well, I'm curious. You know, I've heard that it's can be very stressful writing for TV and for Hollywood. Was that your experience?
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, especially for someone who, coming from the book world, you know, I had my book editors would make a couple of suggestions here and there on my books, right? And say, but it's your book, you know, your name's on it, do what you want. You come out here and you're taking notes. You're taking notes from the time you sell it. I mean, and you're taking notes from people who are totally unqualified to give notes. I mean, you've got a 19-year-old. Somebody who is an assistant for one of the executives whose job is essentially to keep a call sheet, and she's saying things like, well, why is he driving a Firebird? He's in Detroit, and he's driving a Firebird. Why can't he drive a BMW like Tom Cruise in The Firm? And you have to, and you have to, like, respond in a really political way. Right. The key is the politics of it. I mean, you want to say, You dumbass, it's because it's Detroit. They don't have BMWs. You know, they had a sign in the parking lot. They had a sign in the parking lot of the United Auto Workers that says, if you are driving a Japanese car, park it in Tokyo. I mean, that sign is still, I think it's still up there. So, you know, you have to deal with that. That's the stress. And it took me a while to be able to go, oh, that's an, you know, to come back with it, something like, interesting note. Let me look into that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And then do nothing. Yeah. So that's what's stressful.
You're doing better than me. You know, I keep getting into trouble. So, because I don't respond well.
Oh, I got into
too. I don't respond well. I end up, if they catch me at the wrong day and the wrong time, all of a sudden I just sort of shoot out and it's like, oh, everyone's shocked. And I'm getting the emails.
You got to make sure your blood sugar is together. Okay, when you go in there and you meditate a little bit before you go into the meeting. I mean, I had a meeting with Phoenix Pictures and Mike Medavoy and a whole bunch of people there. And there was a director there. And they just worked me over, man, for like 7 hours. They brought out lunch. And, you know, they had lunch called in. And afterwards, the director came and he says, I don't know, how did you do that? How did you take that? I would have gotten a gun and started shooting everybody. That's what the director said. But they beat up the writers, you know. The writer is the, you know, if a film gets great reviews, it's the direction, you know. And if it gets bad, it's like the writer, the script is bad, not the director, the script, that kind of stuff.
For me, that's the hardest part. I've done some book movie deals. And for me, the hardest part is like how you said, you have there's a lot of young people that have just no life experience, throwing things out and you just kind of roll your eyes going, what are you talking about?
No, there's a line in Below the Line where Edwin Blake, the former homicide detective who's now a script consultant, he's talking about taking meetings, and he says he found himself after turning 50 taking meetings with either young women or gay men who looked at him as though he was a father and all the baggage that went with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a whole different experience, but you know, I guess that's, what can you do?
But then there's a David Chase, you know, I mean, David Chase was in his 60s, I think, when he did The Sopranos. And, you know, I mean, there's some people who get it. I did get to work with some cool people. I got to work with Michael Douglas, who, one of my favorite people. We never sold the show, but I just had so much fun. He was at every pitch. He got it all. He was, you know, he's a great artist. He was very supportive. You know, I had good experiences too.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I got to do things that I never thought I'd ever be able to do. And some of the people, David Schwimmer, I worked with him. He was great. God, I think there's more than two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's, so how did you come up with character Edwin Blake? Is that a lot of you, or is that the combination of those people you had experience with in Detroit and homicide, or is it just kind of, where does that all come from? Because when you're writing nonfiction and true stories, it's different than creating a character rather than, you know, because when you're writing true stories, you have the character. You know who they are. You got to find out stuff, and they are who they are. With Edwin Blake, you can tweak them however you want them. So how is that process for you?
Well, yeah, correct. I mean, I knew all the procedural moves that Edwin Blake would make because of all the time I spent doing a true crime and seeing how cops work, and my relationships with some of the Detroit homicide cops that I knew who have, you know, now since retired. I mean, one that I knew well was from Beverly Hills Cop. He played Eddie Murphy's boss in Beverly Hills Cop, Gil Hill. He actually had a short Hollywood career. So I knew how they, you know, I knew how they acted and what they did procedurally. But what I took from myself was the idea of going from a city where the ruts in the snow are 6 inches deep and they're like tracks as you're trying to get to your house because there's no money to plow the streets, yeah. right? To getting on an airplane and arriving in LAX and somebody's got your name with a, on a sign and they've got a town car waiting for you and you're hearing smooth jazz, you know, on the way in, coming from that Detroit thing. And then you're at Warner Brothers and you're seeing the lot and you're seeing like, oh, Casablanca was shot at stage 10 or whatever it was. And you're seeing your favorite movies and, you know, and you come in your first day, you get hired and you're making $3,500 a week, $4,000 a week, which is more than you've ever seen in your life. And you come into your first meeting and you go to the receptionist and of course you're wearing a you know, a coat and tie, you know, cause this is your formal, you know, in Detroit, that's the way it is. And they think you're an attorney and you know, they don't think you're a writer. Writers wear jeans and a shirt never tucked in.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome, like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what-ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You know, there's certain dress codes. So, I mean, there's just all these great little details that I experienced. And so I took a lot of those experiences and also that mindset. I mean, I'll never forget. I went down to the coroner's office, the medical examiner for Los Angeles County, right? And I go into the lobby because I wanted to get a copy of an autopsy because I knew an autopsy in L.A. was going to be maybe a little different than one in Detroit. And I had a scene that required an autopsy report. And so I set it up with the PR guy to go there and pick one up. But while I'm waiting, I'm in this like lobby area and there's people that are crying and they're coming to get their valuables and all that. And I see this door and it says skeletons in the closet. I said to the receptionist, I said, what's that? She said, oh, that's our gift shop. I said, gift shop? I go in there and they're selling t-shirts and yellow crime scene tape. And there's pictures of celebrities on the wall that bought stuff there. And I mean, this is 15 feet away from people who've had their loved ones murdered. Only a door separates it. It was all perfectly normal for them. But boy, did that create a great scene for me, you know, because I took that Detroit mentality of like, what the hell? You know, it's showtime. It's always showtime here. So, you know, it's just like the Lakers, showtime. You know, everything's showtime. And it's show business. It's not show friendship.
Right.
That's a good thing to remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's what I tried to bring. You know, I tried to bring that sense of innocence that, you know, that of someone who grew up in the Midwest. And so I put that into the character.
Yeah. You know,
and that's me. Definitely.
And that's you. I remember the very first show I was on that they filmed me on. And the director, when I showed up, she was, because they had told me what to wear. But then when I showed up, she was like, thought I was Canadian, so she expected me to show up in like, she even said that, don't you have like some flannel and checkered shirt and jeans and all this? So, 'cause she thought you're a writer from Canada, I would be kind of, you know, outdoorsy and rough looking, I guess. And it was just, she was really, really put off. Actually, they sent people out to get me a checkered shirt to wear. I mean,
a maple leaf tie.
Almost. It was just like, wow, you guys really, wow, that's great. Thank you. Do I get to keep the shirt?
I think that's the one thing that's kind of cool about Below the Line, and that's why I wanted to call it a Hollywood crime novel, is it's, even though it's crime, it kind of puts a mirror back on the town here, on L.A. And so, I mean, people have done a lot of, they set things, you know, you got Michael Connelly, and he takes Los Angeles very seriously, you know, with his great books. I mean, the Bosch thing, you know, their stem winders. But I wanted to look at it kind of like Elmore Leonard did in Get Shorty. So to kind of give it just a bit of fun. Even when we designed the cover, we wanted to make the cover kind of fun, you know, let people know that this isn't going to be all Bud Murray. Now that said, there's some really serious stuff that happens in this book. Some really serious stuff. I mean, you know, there's homicides. There's a lot of big surprises in the book, and because there's a lot of hidden agendas, and that's so true here too. You know, the hidden agendas.
Did you have a subtext then? Did you have a theme that or something that you wanted people to get out of it other than the entertainment of the story?
Yeah, I think that comes through with the Edwin Blake's story spine. I mean, the inciting incident of the story is he gets offered to get a writing gig above the line if he can go find this woman and her daughter. And that's a job that's going to be in the future. The producer promises him that in the future. In fact, when he says to him, he says, well, you know, typically that's kind of like a private investigator kind of thing. And that's typically, I'd say, about $700 a day. And the producer says, studio isn't giving me any money, Edwin. I don't have any money. The studio hasn't given me any money. Even though the guy's like driving, you know, a Ferrari and all that, he's not going to spend his own money. So his inside the incident, he gets this job and he thinks that this job is going to get him back into the game. into the Hollywood game because he's bitten on it after a couple of years of doing it. He's had so much, it's been very satisfying, and he doesn't want to go back to Detroit. He's got a girlfriend here, Carla, who's a former roller derby queen. And so he that's his story, is fine to try to he wants to get that job. And I think that the theme that comes true is that his ambition is going to be his greatest force of antagonism. He's going to have to overcome his ambition and do the right thing in order to prevail. So it's, if there's a theme, that's the theme, that, you know, we can get so caught up in things that we create all kinds of problems for us pursuing something that really isn't that important. He finds out what's important in the end.
Are you conscious of how you write sex and violence on the page, especially coming from true crime?
Gunfights and violence is difficult to write in fiction. It really is. It's not. It's a lot easier in true crime because you can say you got autopsy reports and things like that. And but in a novel, you're right there. You're in the scene. And you don't want to go too far. I mean, I like to kind of leave people leaning. You know, it's like Hitchcock said that you want to leave people leaning. And what they meant by that is like they're taking a guy out of a car. Some thugs are going to take a guy out of the car and they're going to throw him off the cliff. The bad way to do it is they drag him to the cliff. They throw him off and the camera sees him fall onto the rocks below. Hitchcock said the better way to do it is you see him struggling, you see his feet against the, you know, stones, they're pulling him over there, and they toss him over the end, and you don't show the landing. And he says the whole audience comes out of their seats trying to look over the edge. And so that's kind of how I handle the violence. I take it right to the edge, and I think that's more effective than getting really graphic. Same with sex, same thing. Sex and death. That's what, you know, we're in the sex and death business in storytelling, aren't we? But those are the two tough things to write. Yeah. In fiction. Absolutely. So I'm very conscious of it. Also, love is another tough one. You know, when somebody loves somebody, I mean, I rewrote there was a Bruce Willis movie called Fire with Fire, and I got called down there to rewrite Bruce's dialogue as a script doctor. And there were other parts that needed to be rewritten because, you know, the I love you was in that screenplay like six or seven times, five times. And I told the producer, I says, you get to say it once, you know. You say it once, it's effective, you know, at a key moment. Same kind of thing. You got to be real careful with that. It can get syrupy or graphic.
Absolutely.
You know, you want to kind of dance around it a little bit. Like, you know what? I mean, a novel, you're telling a giant lie, okay? A novel is an immense giant lie. But why does it work? Because all the details are very truthful. I'm shocked when I see a TV show. Like, I saw a TV show where it was set in Detroit. I don't want to name it. And you got a homicide detective threatening a suspect with the death penalty. Michigan outlawed the death penalty in 1886. It was the first English-speaking government in the world to outlaw the death penalty. There hasn't been a death, you know, there's no death penalty there. So, you know, it's the little details. It's those little things that you've got to get right to tell the big lie of the novel. But what I find you also have to do is you got to give the reader room to visualize and imagine. And if you're too detailed, too graphic, you're taking that away from the reader. Fiction is it's a mutual experience, not only the writer, but the reader. I learned from Elmore, never really describe your people. I mean, you can give them some description, but let people kind of imagine what they look like.
Fill it in.
And also another great Elmore Leonard principle is never start a book with weather. Never start a book with weather. He says, if a book starts with weather, I don't read it. Because it's a cliche. It's a dark and stormy night. You know, it's just a variation of that. He was a big influence on me.
You mentioned dialogue. And, you know, I'm always curious. Because not everybody, they say like 50% of, up to 50% of people don't have an inner monologue. in their heads. They can't hear their thoughts. So I always get interested in how you create dialogue. Can you hear your characters? Can you hear your prose? Is that how you create, or do you do it some other way?
Well, you know, there's two things. There's point of view. I never have more than three point of view characters in a novel because it just gets to be too much. But, you know, how they're thinking, there's that internal dialogue. But when it comes to actual dialogue, I write the dialogue and then I try to cut out as much as possible of the dialogue without losing what's being said. And also what's underneath the dialogue? What's the subtext? What are they really saying? You know, what emotion are they? And I learned that in screenwriting. Actually, that's one of the things in screenwriting that really transferred well back into novel writing for me. And it was very difficult to transfer back to novel writing from screenwriting. Where I had difficulty was getting into the internal dialogue, because after doing all the TV show work and the screenplay work, you've got to show what somebody's feeling. You don't get to go into their head. You can't put a camera in between their ears, right? And so that was kind of difficult for me to get back into that novel point of view. And once I got it, but it's a point of view. Again, it's minimalist. Like you'll find it if you write like four sentences, five sentences of dialogue. If you go back and cut out everything that you could possibly cut out, it becomes much more punchy and much, much better. I mean, the great dialogue writers, you know, it all begins with Hemingway, you know, very minimalist. You know, there's no big long speeches in modern fiction, in most of it at least, hopefully.
That's great advice. So what makes a good book for you? What is it that keeps you reading?
You know, I don't read many books. People think that authors read a lot of books. And some do, but I don't because I read a lot of nonfiction. I read a lot of research books, you know, like stories about cops, you know, stuff like that, things to pick up material. But to actually read a book, or I'll read like C.S. Lewis, you know, about morality and things like that. And people say, well, why aren't you reading a lot of other novels? It's for the same reason that a painter doesn't have the best painted house on a block. Because when you paint all day, the last thing you want to do is come home and paint. And when I'm writing a book, I'm in words, you know, for anywhere from 4 to 7 hours in that process. The last thing I want to do is look at more words when I get, you know, I want to watch something stupid or something good on television. I want to be more passive. But what makes a good book for me, the books that I do like, oh, how do you explain that? You know, I mean, and there are things like, you know, like Silence of the Lambs. I mean, that was right. That one I could not stop reading. Red Dragon. Thomas Harris, right? He's my hero. He wrote three books and he's probably worth millions. And he was done. No, four books. I think he did four. He did Black Sunday, I think was his first. It's got to move. I don't like long chapters. I like short chapters. I like to be kind of hooked, you know, from chapter to chapter. Give me a reason to keep reading. Leave me leaning all the time. I like that kind of thing. That's about the best I can explain that.
Older classics.
I'm not a book critic.
No, I sort of understand. Well, now I'm to the age where I'm listening to a lot of books because it hurts the eyes. But I'm more into listening to older classics myself. I'm trying to catch up in areas that I never had as a kid. But I know what you're saying. But I don't know how you can come home and watch something stupid. There's nothing stupid on TV. It's all good.
Yeah, there is a lot. You know, I binge a lot. You know, I recently watched The Sopranos 20 years ago.
Right.
It's been 20 years.
Hard to believe. Yeah.
I started with the pilot, and, you know, the inciting incident is the ducks fly away. And, you know, he's going to lose his family. That's what he's worried about. That's what the whole series is about. Keeping his family together, keeping the mafia family together and the personal family. And I sat there and I just binged it. I mean, 6 seasons, it took me about a week. And it really was great because we didn't have to wait a week. Remember how we had to wait a week for the next episode? Yeah. And so when you binge it, you see the writing and you see it, and the ending makes all the sense in the world then. In the end, he's got his family together. In that, and then he gets killed. It's very clear that they foreshadow it. several times. And Chase finally admitted it, I think, that Tony dies in the end. It's where the screen goes to black. That's a great way to watch this, rather than waiting from week to week. And I'm watching, the soccer, the football coach who becomes a soccer coach. It's huge.
Oh, Ted Lasso?
It's huge. Yeah, Ted. I'm watching Ted Lasso, yeah. The new season. And I got that, and I went to the first five, and I went to do six, and it says, come next Wednesday. And I thought, no, I got to wait.
Yeah, I see some of them are starting to do that, and some of them are doing it every week, which kind of drives me nuts. I can't do it, because then you forget, and you watch other things. Personally, remember the old days where you'd Friday at 9 p.m. be home because the premiere of this is coming out. And those days don't work anymore. Not for me.
You know, one of the hazards of being a writer, whether you're a screenwriter or a novelist, is it's very difficult to totally absorb yourself in anything that you're going to see. My girlfriends won't go to sounds like I got a bunch.
Yeah, Charlie's Angels. This is Lois Angels.
The girlfriends I've had in the past, they don't want to go to movies with me because, you know, I'll be doing things like, there's the mid movie climax. Oh, we're turning from two to three. This is not going to end well. You know, I could predict everything that's going to happen. And it's difficult to not always be seeing the work. And when I see a great actor or a great writer where I don't see the work and I'm just completely absorbed in it, that's the kind of stuff I like. You know, whether it's a book or a film or a series and I found that with The Sopranos too. I just, after a while, I just surrendered to it, quit trying to analyze it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it still holds up. It still holds up today. It's as good as it ever is. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. I was one of those guys that used to buy the DVD collections back then, and now I have a whole rack of them, but never watch them anymore. It's all streaming. World's changing.
Yeah, in below the line, I deal with some of those changes too. I mean, there's a scene where the producer Jason Perry says, "Got this original idea, and it's great. And you'd be good on it." And it's about a he says it's about a convict who hooks up with a detective, and they're always beating the hell out of each other through the whole thing, but they're solving cases. And Edwin Blake says, well, it sounds like 48 hours. He goes, it is 48 hours. He says, we're doing it for streaming. Like it's original.
Yeah.
You know, that's original because he's going to do it differently. But that's the kind of humor you're going to find in that book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess it's got to be tough in the sense of there's so much streaming now. There's so much need for product. Of shows and things that there's got to be a certain formula that writers use when they have to produce so much stuff so quickly and for so many channels. Like it's hard to, it's a lot harder to get truly original pieces, I think, in that circumstance.
Yeah, well, and they have, you know, writer's rooms, and you got like five or six other brains working trying to break a story. But then you look at like the Vikings series. Right. And when that Vikings series came out on History Channel, I thought it was like some schlocky thing or whatever. I didn't even watch it. And then when it streamed, I thought, oh my God, this is so good. And every episode is written by the creator. He wrote every single episode. David Milch did that too with NYPD Blue. He wrote every episode. He had a room full of writers, but they would just sit around and he would lay on the floor and like pontificate and then leave and then write the episode. So there are these writers that can just like bang this stuff out. I'm not one of those, but it's impressive. I mean, the Vikings series, I mean, how many seasons does that go? Four or five seasons and all written by the same guy.
Yeah. But it's worth it for the end product. It comes out really well.
Yeah.
So listen, I one thing now, how do people, do you like to interact with readers? Are you big on social media, website, all that sort of thing? Or
no, I do. I've got a new, I put up a new website, lowellcaulfield.com, and I'm going to be adding stuff to that. We just got it up. It's got a few things on it. I've also got a YouTube channel called Lowell Caulfield's primary sources. I used to write about music, and uh, I've when Jeff Beck died, I went into my archives and found out I had a 1975 interview with Jeff Beck right before he did his great album, Blow by Blow. And I digitally put that on YouTube with photographs and stuff. So I'm going to be doing a lot of that kind of stuff where I'm going to giving people privy to like original recordings that maybe resulted in books and things like that. That's why I call it primary sources. You get to hear an interview with a serial killer that I'm talking to rather than reading about it. So there's that. I have like 6 followers on Twitter because I never really, it seemed like a cesspool to me. It seemed like there's so much ugly stuff going on Twitter. I just didn't want to dip into it.
It's kind of like a bar fight.
So I got like 6 followers there. I do have a Facebook page, Lowell Caulfield Author, which, I'm going to be expanding, at this point. I have a personal Facebook page that's pretty restricted because for the reasons that we've talked about in this interview, you know, you can get canceled in this town really easy if you say the wrong thing. So I keep that just among friends and family, and it's highly restricted. But I have an author's page there, and you can go to that Lowell Caulfield Author. See what else? I think that's what I got.
No TikTok yet.
So I'm getting out there into this more of the modern world.
Yeah.
Of
kind of needed
communication.
Yeah, nowadays it's kind of something that everyone's looking to. So
well, I love to hear from readers too. I mean, I love to hear from readers.
Well, great.
Although there's always going to be that old lady though that sends that letter that points out every typo in your book.
Yeah.
You know, I've always gotten those with every book. There's somebody that says, do you realize on page 45 there's a typo and there's 5 typos in this whole book? And thinking like, yeah, try writing 80,000 words or editing them and see how many typos you got.
Yeah. You just, I'll give you Dave's address because I send all my hate mail to him.
He does.
And it works really well. It's like everyone loves me. Nobody hates me. It all goes to him. So
there are people protesting outside my house right now.
Yeah, one thing that does kind of get to me is sometimes some critics kind of get to me a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, Publishers Weekly, they did a review and they said that I had use the Hollywood cliches of strippers. By the way, there's no strippers in the book. There's a retired porn star, okay? Strippers, drugs, and pedophilia. And I'm thinking, these are not cliches. This is the grist of what goes on here. I mean, no drugs. I'm to avoid drugs. And, you know, and my people with drug problems are modern drug problem people with, prescription pill, opiate addiction, you know, high-end opiate addiction, very common.
Well, you can't win, you know. So, I've certainly learned that. You just kind of keep moving forward. Can't win with some of that stuff.
Other than that, it was a great review, though. I mean, I got a really good review. They called it a fun, you know, fizzy good ride. And, I take shots at Hollywood, clever shots at Hollywood. So they liked a lot of it, but I think sometimes critics got and I remember doing this when I was doing music criticism to make your credentials. You got to find something wrong or otherwise you look like you're, you know, puffing somebody.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, I know. Yeah, I know. Well, we'll have everything up on the website as well. And of course, your new book as well. It's called Below the Line. It's a Hollywood crime novel. The guest has been the author of that book and many others. Check him out. It's Lowell Caulfield. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Alan and David. My pleasure.
Thanks, Lowell.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.